Hi, it's Meghna Chakraborty, host of On Point. You know, in the process of producing our shows, we oftentimes talk to people who are so interesting that we can't actually fit everything they've said into the course of our regular broadcast. And sometimes we really want to share the totality of our interviews with them because there's a lot to learn. And this week we have the perfect example of that because we did a show about dissecting a disinformation campaign. And in that show, we featured Nina Jankowicz. She's author of How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. And Nina had pointed us to a man named Dmytro Kuleba. Now, Kuleba is right now Ukraine's minister for foreign affairs. But back in 2016, he was Ukraine's ambassador at large for strategic communications. And he had a really interesting job then. Because in 2016, there was a referendum taking place in the Netherlands that had to do with a trade agreement between Ukraine and the European Union. So keep that in mind. It was happening in the Netherlands, had to do with Ukraine and the European Union. And in the middle of all of that, Russia steps in with a really sophisticated and deep disinformation campaign in the Netherlands. So our producer, Dori Scheimer, talked with Dmytro Kuleba about that disinformation campaign and what happened. He shared a lot. So here's that conversation.
So we are talking to you about a very challenging experience in your professional and I'm sure personal life as well. So we want to go back to that time and start by refreshing us on what the referendum was, what you were trying to accomplish that time.
Well, the referendum was a truly unique challenge. Referendum, by definition, is a very domestic process. But when the question put to the referendum refers to a foreign country, especially when the question itself is of vital importance for that foreign country, the referendum gets internationalized immediately. So the biggest challenge for us, and that was what made this process unique, was that we had to act within the framework of the Dutch legislation without interfering into domestic affairs of the Netherlands, under very, I would say, thorough guidance of the Dutch government, because the Dutch government identified the strategy towards the referendum and as it was their domestic issue. And still, we were in that position, you know, on the one hand, you cannot sit and wait with your hands laid down. And on the other hand, when you try to act, you experience tons of limitations or burdens bringing your hands down because they're so heavy. So that was the thing. Still, we managed to organize a campaign within the limits provided to us by the Dutch government. And that was the most unprecedented and large-scale public diplomacy campaign undertaken by Ukraine since gaining independence abroad. And that we mobilized civil society, friends of Ukraine in the Netherlands, government channels, you know, all kind of things. Everything that could be mobilized was mobilized. So this kind of set of conditions and arrangements turned the referendum into a truly big story for Ukraine.
And I mean, from what I've read, this was a pretty conventional PR campaign. You know, you were using all the tools in the toolbox to mobilize, but you are working within the constructs of, you know, how you get the word out and how you convince people of something. And at the same time, there was another group working against your interests. How aware were you at the time of this other group? Were you immediately skeptical of who they were or why they were mobilizing in the way they were?
Well, of course we were. I mean, things were pretty obvious, but you know, when you deal in a foreign country, when you you have to respect this country and the political structure of the society and the role of domestic players. And standing up and pointing at someone saying, oh, this is Russia's, this is a clear Russia's agent would simply play against us. So basically, you had to accept the rules of the fight, which were basically imposed on us, and fight in a pretty absurd environment where you have to convince everyone that you are not an elephant. You know, that's that was the issue. Russia was not caught red-handed in the Netherlands those days. But we saw that the narratives which were being used by our opponents were somehow exactly the same as the Russian narratives. That was obvious. We saw that people coming campaigning against Ukraine, like ordinary people who could not stay indifferent indifferently, sometimes were not Dutch. They were coming from other countries, also from Ukraine, but then showing and spreading Russian narratives in the country. And we also faced another thing, which is this overly skeptical, EU skeptical narrative present in the Dutch society and in the Dutch political system. So in that sense, this was not a referendum only about Ukraine. This was also a referendum about the European Union and its relationship with third countries. This is an important point that has to be remembered all the time. The referendum was about Ukraine, was only partially about Ukraine. It was also about the attitude of the Dutch society towards the EU. And the third element, it was this thrilling experiment that the Dutch society was undertaking to hold a referendum of that kind. I will remind that the law that provided for the opportunity to hold such referendums was not an easy gore. It was a very difficult decision for the Dutch parliament. And the referendum of Ukraine was the only undertaking arranged under that law. The law was then suspended. There was suspended afterwards. So this was this moment of an experiment of trying something new was also in the air, and it could be felt.
I have a lot of questions. So, I mean, first of all, I would think being in Ukraine, you were more familiar with the tactics that Russia uses in all sorts of applications than the Dutch were. Did you get a sense that there was some like naivete in the Netherlands about what the Russians were capable of or how they may be involved?
Well, perhaps foreign minister should not call its a partner country naive. So I will find I'm desperately looking for a better word to describe that situation. But we clearly saw that things were unfolding in accordance with well-written scenarios, which were not played or directed for the first time. What was happening was absolutely obvious to us. What we heard from our partners when we said this to them was that, there is a culture of dialogue. We have to take into account different opinions. So that's why I'm saying that we had to play by the rules of the society that was preparing itself to go to the polling stations and vote. And I felt at some moments exhausted by just trying to convince that, guys, this is not happening. This propaganda and disinformation attacks, you will suffer from them as well if you do not take measures to prevent, if you do not build your resilience, and if you do not allow these guys to exploit democracy in the interests of disinformation and propaganda. Unfortunately, no one was willing to hear us at that point. They were still considering this whole process as a part of a regular democratic discussion. And I think this is one of the biggest vulnerabilities of democracy, when we allow abusers to take advantage of democracy by using its openness, its transparency, and its fixation on dialogue as a mean to move forward.
Fixation on dialogue. I love that phrase. What kind of disinformation? What were the videos saying? What was the message being used against you? And how were they spreading it?
The overall message was that Ukraine is a bad country. It's a bad country that does not deserve a closer relationship with the European Union, a bad country whose migrants will flow the Netherlands once the association agreement comes into force, a bad country a bad country space, and then you start putting in whatever you want. That was the narrative, that Ukraine is a bad country, and that's it.
And I want to go back to something that you said earlier, talking about how there was already this sentiment present in the Netherlands of anti-Europe, wanting to maybe, push back against the status quo of government that went beyond, obviously, this referendum. But it was a way to, prove that attitude. How important is that? The presence of that kind of those attitudes in allowing a country like Russia to capitalize and to be more effective? Is it a crucial piece of the puzzle for them to be effective?
Well, I believe that the overall Russia's approach to meddling and manipulating other societies is twofold. On the one hand, they create divisions where they can. On the other hand, they use existing divisions. And the Netherlands was the place where they applied the second tactics. They simply carefully studied what was dividing the Dutch society, what were the issues, what were the burning issues in domestic politics, and started playing with that. And that was the tactics applied. In Ukraine, for example, they use both from time to time. They either throw in narratives less successfully now, which create divisions, but in most of the cases, they actually play with existing divisions. It's like, you have an open wound, and instead of healing it, someone sticks his finger into the wound and starts digging it. That's what Russia does. They usually simply stick their finger into the wounds of foreign societies.
How did it feel when you ultimately lost that referendum?
I emptied a bottle of wine, if that could be an answer. I believe, the difficulty domestically, from the very beginning, I realized that it was rather mission impossible because of all the limitations imposed on us. On the other hand, it was also impossible to do nothing. Neither our society, neither our public opinion, nor myself could forgive doing nothing in that particular circumstances. So it's like, it's like a battle against tanks and you only have a rifle in your hands, but you understand that most probably you will still get killed, but you cannot sit in the trench. You have to stand up and attack and defend yourself from the attackers. So that was kind of a situation. And during the election vote, I remember in the first half of the day, there was heavy rain in the bad weather in the Netherlands, and messages came, people will not show up because of bad weather. And there was this glimpse of hope at a certain moment that there will not be a sufficient amount of people who will cast their ballots. But the moment I realized that people are actually coming, the outcome was pretty obvious to me. So I took it with, rather calmly. I did not throw anything against the wall. Let's put it in an act of desperation. But I felt upset. I went to the TV, to the talk show, where I had to comment on the outcomes. And I had a very, relieved heart on that, at that moment, because I knew one thing. We did more than we could under the circumstances. And that was true. Very few people questioned that, because we really did more than we could. But this is life. Sometimes you lose, sometimes you win. So after coming home, I just, as I said, I just emptied a bottle of wine.
That seems fair enough. So this happened in 2014, correct?
Yeah. I think it was April 2016.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Thank you for correcting me.
Yes.
So this happens in April 2016. In November 2016, the U.S. has an election. Donald Trump wins that election. I know you don't want to use the word naive, but again, it feels like a country is completely unprepared, unaware of the way Russia is putting its thumb in the wound and digging deeper. From your perspective, were you watching the election play out in the U.S. and seeing some of the same tactics that had just been used against you a few months earlier?
Well, to wrap up on the Netherlands, I must, one important detail is that though we lost the referendum, the association agreement was eventually signed. And there was a diplomatic effort taken to find a diplomatic solution to that problem. And the government of the Netherlands played constructively, and I should commend them for that. So the results of the referendum did not jeopardize signing of this association agreement between Ukraine and the EU. Turning to the United States and crossing the ocean, I must tell you that since 2014, the United States were very advanced and open-minded to learning from Ukraine its experience in countering Russia's disinformation campaigns. So I cannot say that the United States were not prepared. They possessed sufficient volume of information about the way Russia operates and runs its malign activities abroad. What I believe the United States did not expect to happen, and this is my personal assumption, the United States did not believe Russia would dare to apply the same kind of tactics in the United States domestically. You know, I believe that this was the biggest surprise to DC, that Russia was bold enough and self-assured that it says that it had sufficient resources to play this game on the soil of the United States of America. Again, now everything we're discussing now is irrelevant because it's a conventional wisdom these days that Russia can meddle anywhere, can do an disinformation campaign even in the territory of countries which are friendly to them, like they did in Italy or in Spain. But at that time, Western countries still believed that this war is taking place somewhere else, but it will never come to our soil. And I believe that the case of the United States was very, very eloquently demonstrated that it can. And we are seeing that ever since.
I think from my own, maybe small base of knowledge, but you think of like countries interfering in elections, countries having these kinds of conflicts as being really sophisticated, that you know, it was about cybersecurity and hacking and I don't know, more sophisticated than videos and disinformation on social media. But how effective is that? Or is there any way to combat the effectiveness of a country like Russia getting involved in the spread of information?
Well, it's a fair and a good question. It becomes effective only if it's applied continuously in a very systemic manner. Every time you interrupt an attack, or every time you build up the resilience of your institutions and your society, every time you prevent the attack, you win. But you should always remember that you win in a battle, which does not mean winning the war. Because when a country has sufficient resources and political will to continue attacking another country with disinformation, fakes, manipulations of all kinds, and malign activities and cyber attacks and malign activities, it will continue. It will continue doing it time after time. And it doesn't matter how strong you are. This war will continue until the attacker drops, you know, this strategy. And this is something we should all be aware of. You cannot say, oh gosh, you know, we identified these hackers group, bears or whatever, the Russian sponsored, government sponsored hacker groups. We locked them down. We blocked them their access. This is not the end of the story. Another group will attack, and so forth and so on. And as our societies remain to be democratic, we cannot but expose ourselves to being attacked, because this is the nature of democracy. You know, this is why autocracy is more resilient in that context, because they can control the narrative, the flows of narratives inside of their country. Strategically, this resilience, you know, it's not as sustainable as the democratic resilience, but tactically, non-democratic countries, they can better defend themselves from foreign counter narratives, or and that's also something that we should be aware of.
Is there a way, do you think, for democracies to become more resilient against these kinds of attacks?
Of course, it's you know, democracy should be responsible. You know, this famous disclaimer: drink responsibly. It's the same with democracy. Practice democracy responsibly. Do not expose yourself. Do not bring democracy to an absurd. Freedom has its limits, especially when it comes to the survival and to the prosperity and the safety of your own society. My favorite example for that is this rule of a second opinion. You know, I remember cases when a foreign media was reporting on a certain event or situation, and it was providing the, for example, the position of Ukraine on that situation. And then it was providing the Russian position on that situation. And the Russian take was purely manipulative. It was basically disinformation. But according to the two opinions, this Russian manipulation would still make it to the viewers or to the listeners. Because, of course, you have to listen to the other side. But what do we do when the other side lies? How should we treat its opinion? What is the validity of that opinion? Should we broadcast that opinion to the millions of viewers simply because it's the opinion of a liar? These are kind of challenges and things which have to be addressed by democracies if we really want to make them stronger.
What concerns you the most about disinformation campaigns going forward?
You know, after being in this business, in the business of fighting disinformation and fakes for years, nothing really concerns me. I believe that things are evolving pretty obviously, in a very obvious way. What bothers me in a way is the inability of platforms to counter disinformation in a systemic way. I mean, we all read with pleasure news saying that this social media or another one shut down like a thousand of groups and accounts for spreading manipulative information. It's good. Things like this should be happening. But in general, social media platforms, they create this environment, the perfect environment for spreading something that is even worse than fakes and disinformation. And I mean manipulative interpretation of reality. This is something one finds very difficult to counter, because this kind of manipulation rests within the realm of democratic debate, I would say, or the debate or the discussion that is very conventional for democracy. But I see more and more, I see a growing impact of these opinions, of these manipulative opinions on the society, on the users of social media accounts, on users of social media. And I can hardly see the way this issue can be addressed. You can shut something down or lock someone down for spreading obvious fakes, but it's really hard to find the rule or the legitimate argument to shut down someone who is simply rottening. Is there such a verb, to rotten? Yeah, rottening your brains with endless manipulative interpretations of reality. So people simply get lost and they do not trust anyone. We live in times when, there is no big truth anymore. There are this multiple truths, and everyone chooses the truth he or she wants to believe in. And this thing, I don't want to advertise, this thing is an excellent tool for anyone who can feed us with endless doubts about the reality we live in.
Well, this has been very fun for me to talk with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Anything else you want to add, or any questions I've missed?
No, I really enjoyed talking to you, and this is an endless story, and I'm sure that we may touch base again after some time to discuss the next phases of
this fight. I mean, I guess that would be my last question. Like, is the cat out of the bag? Is there any way to go back to getting to that one singular truth, or
no?
You know, that's over. Those days are over.
In my opinion, the only way forward is to teach people to choose the right truth. According to scientists, this famous confirmation bias, right? That if people start to believe in things, it gets extremely difficult to change their opinions. A friend of mine recently asked me why I'm not answering to comments on Facebook, to which I replied that I have never seen a discussion in comments on Facebook, even between the brightest intellectuals with the most convincing arguments, the discussion that would lead to someone changing his or her initial opinion. The more people exchange comments on Facebook, the more convinced they become in their initial arguments, and the more fiercely they defend them. So,
and at some point, we just have to protect our own mental health.
Yeah. So, yes, exactly. I believe that the pharmacy industry will make a lot of money on this thing, but and healthcare system as well. But we have to think about the future generations and teaching them to live in a world of multiple truths and making the right choices in that world. This is all what we can. Our generation is that, in that sense, is kind of lost to me. But we have to invest in education of our children, how to live in the world where any truth can be described as a lie and vice versa.
Minister, thank you so very much for taking the time.
Yes, yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you.
Dmytro Kuleba is Ukraine's Minister for Foreign Affairs, and he talked with On Point producer Dori Scheimer. That hour, by the way, on the anatomy of a disinformation campaign, which will show up, if it's not already, in your podcast feed, it was produced by On Point producer Anna Bauman. So thanks, as always, for listening. We hope you enjoy these extended interviews, because there's a lot to learn out there. We want to share as much of it as we can with you. So if you value that kind of stuff, now's the time. As I always say, tap on that subscribe button. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you again soon.